My guest is Bruce Morrow, the radio disc jockey better known as Cousin Brucey. From 1961 to 74, he was the most colorful voice on WABC-AM, the New York station that made top 40 radio into a science. Cousin Brucey was fast-talking but friendly, and his hit song Countdown, the WABC Super Hit Survey, was essential listening for teenagers. WABC was clear channel, so Cousin Brucey was heard in 40 states and Canada, and in his heyday in New York, one-fourth of the entire radio audience tuned in. He left radio temporarily after album-oriented FM stations overshadowed AM Top 40. He bought several suburban radio stations and a TV station, but he sold them when he returned to radio on WCBS-FM in New York. He's revived his hit song Survey, now called the Cousin Brucey New York Countdown, and he can also be heard on Cruisin' America, which is a syndicated show carried on CBS radio stations around the country. Bruce Morrow has written a memoir. It's titled Cousin Brucey, My Life in Rock and Roll Radio, and it's just been published by Beechtree Books. Welcome to Fresh Air.
Thank you very much. It's so nice. I love getting fresh air. I've been traveling all over the place. I'll tell you, this authorette business is tough. I call myself an authorette, like a launderette.
A mini author, isn't it?
Yeah, that's what I am.
You know, you came into rock radio. You came into radio at a real transition where Perry Como was on the charts at the same time as Elvis. Andy Williams and Fats Domino were on the charts at the same time.
I remember we had How Much Is That Dog in the Window? And K, Sarah, Sarah, whatever, Doris Day. And suddenly, come on, baby, let's go downtown. Bill Haley and the Comets started getting on the thing. And all of a sudden, the Platters, who are these things? Who are these people? And these traditional radio personalities who were doing Vic Damone and those things started going crazy. And I remember them going, oh, my, what is going on here? I was seduced by radio at a very early age. And I was really in the first generation of rock babies. I was the first generation. And boy,
you
I
were in the
it.
First generation of rock disc jockeys.
Yes, yes. We wrote the rules. We did it.
You said you'd listen to Alan Freed before you got started.
He was really my hero. Alan Freed and Murray. I grew up with Murray and Alan Freed. And it was a whole new feeling. You know, we have to go back a little bit. Rock music really was the first music, first kind of poetic music in the history of recorded history in time that youth had as their own. Every other type of music, whatever era we're talking about, was handed to them by the adult world, by the leaders, by their parents. Here was something that young people were able to latch onto and hold and say, this is our own. I came along, and I was like a bridge between parents and kids. I spoke their language. I had the same feeling and energy as the music, and they trusted me, and they also trusted me to talk to their parents saying, hey, Mom and Dad, this is all right. It's going to be all right for the kids. Don't worry about it.
Can I ask you to do Cousin Brucey for a minute?
Yeah, I'm sure there's a lot of people in this big audience of yours here that say, who is this guy, Cousin Brucey? Well, let me just preface my remarks, and I will certainly reenact. I'll take you back to see. I'll give you a Tuesday in 1962. I'll give you a perfect Tuesday. And Cousin Brucey is like, in fact, I'm still doing exactly the same thing. It's a bubble. A very happy individual. It's real. It is not phony. It doesn't sound like, hi, everybody, here's a disc jockey on a tower of power with your high stack of black shellac. None of that nonsense. You know, this disc jockeying, or none of the early FM syndrome with, good evening, everybody. How are you? I am a stiff FM disc jockey. None of that stuff. I'm a happy guy. Everybody listening in their area grew up with a Cousin Brucey. A Cousin Brucey is a friend, an electronic friend that you can reach by turning a key called a radio, a magic box, and no matter where you're listening, you had this guy who was a friend, and he'd give you solace. He was your balm, B-A-L-M. That's what Cousin Brucey is. Let me take you back a little bit, and I'll give you a demonstration so people will understand what we're talking about. I wish I could touch out and reach and touch everybody. I love to touch people, you know. All right, it's a Tuesday night. I'm just coming out of a record, and I'd say something like, oh, that was so great. Hey, Cousin, was that fabulous Monkees brand new sound? And I'm telling you, Monkees are going to be around forever, and I'm telling you now, it's 1963. Remember, sometime in 1987, people are going to say, hey, those are the Monkees. Kids are going to still love them because they are fabulous. Hey, coming up very shortly, John, Paul, George, and Ringo. Brand new group that Cousin Brucey's bringing in from England. I think they call themselves, it sounds like a rodent, the Beatles. It never happened. How dare these English upstarts take our rock and roll, American rock and roll, and they think they're going to sing it. It'll never happen, kids. It'll never happen. Listen, you have pimples? Let me tell you what to do with your blemishes. It's something brand new here. Cousin Brucey tried it, and it works. You can listen to Cousin Brucey. I'm your friend. It's called Blemetina Go-Go. Now, Blemetina Go-Go works very easily. You simply take it, put a little, I'm doing it right now, kids, and I'm putting it on my finger, dabbing it on my face, and I can promise you one thing from your Cousin Brucey. If it doesn't work in 3 days, your money and your pimples back. This is Cousin Brucey right now on WWW, and I have a brand new song. And this goes out to Johnny and Mary, and they're going steady for 3 months. And kids, best of luck. I want everyone doing their homework. homework now, or I don't want you listening. Finish your homework while you're listening to me, or you got to turn the radio off. Cousin Brucey presents a brand new record. This is by a fella named Little Stevie Wonder. You'll love it. It's called Fingertips Part 2. Spin the record.
You were one of the early fast talkers. Now, you weren't a motor mouth.
No.
But you
it
were pretty
had content. It was fast.
But you were pretty fast. Did that ever get you into trouble? Did people, your early station managers or program directors ever criticize you for talking too fast?
People criticized me constantly. I mean, the newspapers in those days, they said, hey, it would never last. Rock and roll. Or they used to call it, Terry, in those days, rot and roll. A lot of people still do, but everyone knows it's part of our culture. It is an art form. It is a poetry. It's a minstrel of its day. It's a newspaper. It's a radio. People would say, why do you talk so fast? So I would say to my critics, why do you listen so slowly? That's how I get out of it. People tend to, if they catch every other word, they're okay. I match the meter of the music. The energy is me, the energy is the music. And I'm still like that. I love what I'm doing. Talking to you right now and getting on the air is like the first time every time.
You had theme carts and theme songs for your show. Mm-hmm. There was one where voices would go, Cousin Brucey, Cousin Brucey.
Cousin Brucey. I still use that. And if they listen, anybody in New York City listening, I know you carried on WNYC in New York, right?
Mm-hmm.
And if anyone listens in that area or New Jersey or Pennsylvania or Connecticut, they will still hear that card, followed by the Four Seasons theme with Moving and a Grooving, Everybody's Going to Have Fun, Cousin Brucey. Those voices, one of them is my dad.
Really? That's great.
Yeah. It's a license plate. People love to identify with something. And when I go on the air, they know it's their friend, Cousin Brucey.
You were there for the real, for the developing of Top 40 into a science. I think it's not unfair to say that.
You can call it a science, yes.
Why is it the Top 40? Why not the Top 50, the Top 30, the Top 25?
Well, let me take you back to about 1956, 57 to the Midwest. A couple people are in a bar, in a tavern. And these people are radio people, and they own a couple radio stations, this particular company, and they're playing country and western music, and nothing's really happening. They're noticing, though, every time they go into this bar, they're hearing the same songs. They count the songs, and there's 40 of them, right? And then they notice out of the 40 songs being constantly repeated all night by putting nickels. You remember what a nickel is, Terry? Remember years ago we used something called a nickel? No more, right? And they noticed they kept count for about 3 days, and they noticed that people were playing the same songs, and the top 10 were playing more repeatedly than anything else. So they started keeping a thing, and they said, well, if it works in this bar, why don't we try it on the radio? Top 40 Radio was born. It just happened that it would happen to be 40 records in that jukebox. That's what it was.
How did you compile the Top 40 for ABC and for the Super Hit Survey?
We used to call record stores, and we used to go out and talk to people. They'd call 50 or 60 record stores in the tri-state area every single week, and they were very careful. And then, of course, the record company started getting involved and has started hyping things. And, you know, we went through the payola situation, which the radio industry has never recovered from the 60s. We're still rocking and reeling from that particular original payola scandal. But that was done. We arrived at the top 20 or top 15 by calling record stores. And we used to take votes on the phone, too.
What were the rules for you when you were doing Top 40 Radio at ABC?
Rules.
You didn't have to play the number one song once an hour, once a half hour, or something like that.
When we first started, Terry, before that happened, before the consultants came in, and a consultant to me is a very dirty word.
Uh-huh.
How can a guy in San Diego tell Cousin Brucey in New York what to play and vice versa? A radio station is a very unusual animal. It's a magic animal that has an understanding and a sensitivity for its particular market. It's very, very intimate. Right now, I wonder how many people you and I are in bed with. I wonder how many people are taking showers or baths or getting dinner ready or doing gardening or whatever. We are right there, right in somebody's, right in the most intimate parts of people, and we're right in the ear. And in those days, I was talking directly to people, but there were no rules because I and people like Cousin Brucey, we were writing the rules. The business guys, who I referred to in my book as SOBs, which is sons of business, so nobody gets upset listening to me, they left me alone and they left people like me alone because they didn't understand what we were doing. But suddenly, money makes the world go around was coming into the coffers. And then as it grew, as more money started coming in, they got nervous. P&L, the statements came in, the profit and loss, and they realized, hey, there's something here. We better watch this and be very careful. Then the rules started coming in. You were referring to one particular rule. Rick Sklar, who also wrote a book called Rockin' America, who is my dear friend, who philosophically he and I will very rarely agree on anything in radio. He was my boss in those days. We're very dear friends to this very day. We dinner all the time together, and he's always on the road too. I always used to go on these trips, and every once in a while he'd come back from another station with a new rule. And this rule drove me crazy and my fellows on the air crazy. He brought in 4 clocks. They would look like alarm clocks. And every and each clock had a red, one had a red light, one had a yellow light, one had a blue light. So instead of ringing, a light would go on. The first clock was set at 45 minutes. And no matter what you were doing, no matter what, except a commercial, if that light went on at 45 minutes, you'd have to play the number one record. At 50 minutes, the number two record, blue light, would go on. And then at 55 minutes, the yellow light. Well, I couldn't handle this. So I got myself a screwdriver, took it apart. Those things never lit when I was on the air. Never. Then they started things like no record over 2.5 minutes, which is ridiculous. No record, Cousin Brucey. You can't play anything earlier than 1963, The Beatles. Now, for me to go on the radio, which I love, to this day I will not use a computer. Nobody programs my show but me. And not play The Platters or Earth Angel or Jerry Lee Lewis or Chuck Berry's, all the greats of rock and roll, I cannot do that. So what I did is I relabeled every cartridge. Suddenly Earth Angel from 1955 became 1965. I relabeled. Nobody ever caught on.
Sure, you must have been pretty angry thinking, here you are, one of the people who helped create Top 40 radio, and suddenly the quote experts are coming in and telling you what you really ought to be doing in order to be popular.
Well, I never mind good criticism. I never mind somebody who's talented for direction. I love direction. But somebody who doesn't have a feeling of a market has no right to market. Like you, say somebody comes into Philadelphia and they live in Kansas City and they really don't have a feeling for Philadelphia. You can't do that. Not with radio. It's too sensitive a magic device. You can't do it.
I want to talk a little bit about when the Beatles first came to America. You were on the air.
Happy time.
Murray Kaufman, also known as Murray the K, was on the air. And you were the two biggest rock and roll disc jockeys at the time. And it was a real big fight between your two stations.
Yes.
As to who was going to get the more play out of the Beatles, who was going to break the records, who was going to get the more interviews, who was going to MC the concerts. What was happening behind the scenes in those battles?
Chaos. Every time a record, everyone would fight. Matter of fact, it still goes on today, but you see what's happening with the Bruce Springsteen record. There's all kinds of lawsuits. As everybody tries to get, we call them exclusives. And we try to show our audience, a music audience, that we are the station that gets the music first. With the signal of WABC, which used to reach 40-some-odd states, we used to get a lot of complaints from our sister stations in Pittsburgh. Why do you have the Beatle record and I don't? This type of thing. Because the listeners in Pittsburgh would listen to Cousin Brucey at night. Behind the scenes, it was chaotic. People like Murray. You know, in my book, I'm very critical of Murray. Plus, but I'm also, I hand him many bouquets about his talent. Personally, he was a rather unsavory character as far as I'm concerned. I explained that in the book. Murray latched himself on, and so did a lot of other disc jockeys as the fifth Beatle. The boys did not like this. Now, I kept my stay. I was away. They were up with me. They used to come on the air live with me. They called me on the air many times. I introduced them with Ed Sullivan at Shea Stadium the first time. Murray and a few other people decided they were going to become the, quote, fifth Beatle, which was ridiculous. They were latching on to something. I must say, Murray and those people really knew what they were doing. They were very smart. They saw that this was more than just a music industry thing. I mean, the Beatles, after all, did, Terry, affect us sociologically. They affected our hairstyling, our mode of dress. They affected the way we talk, our language. I'll tell you a cute, quick story, if I may.
Sure.
2 weeks before the Beatles came, Howie Greenberg from the Bronx would call me and say something like this. Hey, Cousin Brucey, this is Howie Greenberg from the Bronx. Hey, buddy, I love you. Would you play a record for my girlfriend Susie? We love you. Play anything, will you? All right, that's Howie Greenberg. 2 weeks later, the Beatles arrive in America, and they take everybody by storm. Suddenly, Howie Greenberg calls me that same night, but now Howie Greenberg sounds like this. Hello, old thing. How are you, ducky? This is Howie Greenberg from the Bronx. Good show. Would you play a request from me and my bird? They affected everything we did, and they still do.
I knew a lot of people like that. Oh, suddenly got English accents.
Oh, yeah. So everybody spoke the mother language, the mother tongue. They affected everything about it, and they also saved the American music industry, even though they wreaked havoc on the charts for over a few years during the British invasion. There were only a couple American groups that were really saving the industry from complete loss on the top 10.
You mentioned a story about this other disc jockey, Murray the K, Murray Kaufman, who you were very competitive with behind the scenes. And the big controversial part of this in your book is you describe how he knocked you off the air at WINS.
Well, he was a young man, a young boy, really not very savvy to the ways of the world. And Murray wanted my slot, which was 7 to 10 o'clock, and he paid off. I mean, we know about this. I did not name too many other names besides Murray, and he got a little bribery, and he paid the sales manager off, and suddenly Cousin Brucey was offered the all-night gig. I was like a 20-year-old kid, and I said no, and I left the station, and it was my first big heartbreak in life.
So you think things were pretty vicious behind the scenes between competing DJs?
Yes. Oh, they still are. Terry, let's not kid each other now. WABC, we're very friendly. I mean, to this day, Ron Lundy, Dan Ingham, Harry Harrison, all these guys are going to be at a surprise birthday party that I'm getting. My wife is giving me a surprise birthday party this Sunday, my 28th birthday. Now, the people who know me, they'll think I'm 28 and I'm happy. I've been lying about my age. Now this darn book, I can't lie anymore. Everyone knows how old I am. Tremendous competition. Some of us were very lucky. I got a lot of the newspaper and the television all the time. I was always in the public eye. A lot of people didn't like that. They got, you know, a little jealous about that. So there were always a lot of infighting, and it was not as friendly as it seemed. On the air, it always said, hey, we're the good guys. Yeah, hey, everyone, it's terrific. But backstage, forget it. You know, we just sort of stayed away from each other. On the air, though, everybody was quite professional.
You know, I've always thought of Cousin Brucey as being the alter ego of Bruce Morrow, but I have to say, you really do talk quickly in person.
Well, it's not really quickly. You know, Terry, it's not an alter ego. The day that I got the name Cousin Brucey from that nice little lady, I became Cousin Brucey. And Cousin Brucey's very real. I really believe that we owe each other something as relatives of the human race. And as long as somebody's nice and I can look in their eyes, I feel a warm. I feel a kinship to people all over this nation of ours, and I travel a lot. I love people, and I get it back. Oh, no matter where I go, I get it back.
My guest is Bruce Morrow, also known as Cousin Brucey, who's written a memoir, which is called Cousin Brucey, My Life in Rock and Roll Radio. We're going to talk more about Cousin Brucey and radio after the short break. This is Fresh Air. Cousin Brucey, Bruce Morrow, is my guest, who's been one of America's biggest top 40 DJs, and he's written a memoir called Cousin Brucey, My Life in Rock and Roll Radio. When you were, you know, at the peak of Top 40 Radio, when did you start to realize that there were signs that something was happening in FM? And
well,
suddenly there were albums being played
right. Instead
of
well,
singles.
Well, it wasn't only albums. I think it started, you know, we are really a reflection of society. We're not projectors. We are reflectors. And I was watching what was happening. Suddenly people were wearing long hair. We started losing something called innocence about 1968, 1970. Trust was out the window. Civil rights strife, tremendous. We were rocking and reeling from Korea. Vietnam was coming in. The whole nation was being ripped apart, the young against the old. Nobody trusted each other. When distrust started, that's when it all really happened. And I knew something was very different. I didn't know yet, but I knew something was going to happen. Music was changing. As I said, music, the folk music of the youth, is their reflector. That's their cry. That's their poetry. And suddenly, lyrics were changing. The simplistic structure of the music, the simplistic lyrics from Moon, Spoon, June, Let's Go Downtown, Honey, Meet My Baby Susie, Wake Up, Little Susie, We're in Trouble, It's 2 o'clock, and Our Parents Are Nowhere. And now the music was saying something very different. It was crying. It was saying things that I, in my generation, did not understand. I knew something was happening. And then suddenly this sleeping giant called FM, which was sleeping since the middle of World War II, awakened. And it started stirring. And little by little, we noticed numbers changing. AM radio was chipping away, a chip-chip here and a chip-chip there, and FM was coming in. A new breed of radio personality was born that was not anything like I ever heard before. It was, you remember the early FM syndrome, Jock? Remember that?
Sure, well, it was just the opposite. It was slow talking,
very
reading
quiet,
poetry on the air.
Like a voice like this. You know, it sounds like the Atlanta airport drone. Good morning, you are now at B Concourse. You know, they talk like
one of your colleagues switched over.
Yeah,
Scott Muni. Yeah.
Scott is doing very well. He's still operation director over there at NEW.
Did you ever think, well, I'd better change my style.
No,
I'd better get hip to what's happening on this FM
station. No, I wanted to leave.
You wanted to get out of radio?
Yeah, well, not out of radio. That's when I decided it's time for me to buy my own stations and do my own thing. No, I couldn't do that. I didn't like the music. I don't want to play Moby Grape. I don't want to play Twisted Sister, which, of course, there was no Twisted Sister in those days. I don't want to play any of that heavy rock. I don't like it. I don't understand it. It's not my generation. I don't have a sense of humor. I don't have the feeling. I don't have the meter. I had to leave it alone. A lot of people with me stood on the side for a long time, and little by little, I knew it was time to get out. Get out. I was doing television at this time quite a bit for NBC television. I did a lot of all the entertainment reporting for NBC TV News. I was on NBC for a while, and it was time to get out. I met my partner, and we started buying radio stations. I bought an airplane, and I flew all over all my stations, and I did Cousin Brucey for those next 7 years on my own radio stations.
You know what I wonder, too? The audience for Top 40 Radio has been a fairly young audience in a lot of ways.
No more.
You think? Well, you're playing oldies now.
Well, remember now. Remember.
But here's what I'm thinking. That did you feel that as you were getting older, that the listeners were getting younger, and that there was a greater disparity growing between your audience and you?
But let's talk about today. My audience today are the people who grew up with Cousin Brucey, are now people in their 30s, 40s, 50s who have children. And what's happening now with the resurgence of this fabulous music from the 50s and 60s, and it's the biggest, most exciting music in the country today, not only am I playing my music, but I'm also playing music of people like Springsteen, people like Billy Idol, people like Tiffany, and we can go right down the list of people who are now doing the 60s and 1980 styles. I think it's very healthy and very nice. It also tells the music industry something very important. But that's a science. I did know that the audience would grow up, and we no longer would be playing necessarily just to teenagers like we were back in the 50s, that sometime along the line we'd be talking to adults, and that, of course, is where it's all at.
Did you have a big identity crisis when you left ABC and when you left AM radio?
Oh, yeah. Terrible time. Terrible time. To this day, I got to tell you something. My identity is so close with ABC that I know that in rating books today, I am still quoted to be on ABC. That's how strongly I've been identified with that radio station. I'm on CBS FM in New York City, and I still do the same thing. A lot of the guys used to be on ABC are on there now, and I still do Cousin Brucey on my network show. It's me, if you heard it. But the identity crisis was not with me. It was with my audience. They always have me there on AM radio at ABC, which is fine. I don't want to disturb their memories.
It's, I think, always a dream of radio hosts, especially frustrated radio hosts, to one day own a station so that they could create their dream station. But once you actually owned, six or eight stations.
Eight radio stations.
Were you able to create your dream on it?
Yes.
And was your dream different once you were the owner as opposed to a host?
Well, I had to wear two hats and it was a little difficult. I didn't want to find myself being one of those guys in business that stifled creativity. So I told all my people, I want you to make mistakes. I told my program director, make some mistakes. Talk it over with me. Maybe I can help you. But please, I want you to make some mistakes, because if you don't make mistakes, you're in trouble with me. That means they're being creative. And what you're doing here, you are doing radio that is sensitive, and you are a friend to people. They know who you are. They know how you feel and how you think. And you're reaching people on a one-to-one basis. My radio stations did the same thing right in the midst of all this nightmare with the consultants and the computers. It's essential that radio keeps an identity of friendship and fun. And that's what I've been fighting for. And I think I'm winning my battle.
You got into radio just at about the time of the Paola scandals, which didn't ever touch you. And
no,
as you say in your book,
you
weren't even, quote, important enough at the time to be bought off. You were just in your radio infancy.
Twice. One time somebody offered me two apple pies because his mother baked apple pies. I turned them down.
You shouldn't have
confessed
to that.
The second time somebody came over and offered me something, and I said, listen, and I'm going to tell you very truthfully, Terry, if you offer me anything under $250,000 in cash, go away. If you offer me $250,000 in cash, let's talk business. I'll take a chance for that. Of course, when I was being sarcastic, say, get out of here, buddy. I don't need it. We were making a lot of money in those days. Radio was always very good to me. We were all doing way into the six figures back in 1960, and that's a lot of money for radio. But we were doing so well for ABC that they would give us anything. Plus, we doubled and trebled that on the outside with appearances and commercials, doing commercials on television shows.
Were there subtler ways of pay for play, favors that would be done?
Oh, sure.
Instead of just like giving somebody a big stash of money, are there other
ways?
Yeah,
that's a little blatant. Yeah, sure there are. There's all kinds of favors that can be done. Listen, Terry, let's not kid each other. Every business has commercial bribery. I don't care if it's trucking, if it's garbage cleaning, if it's bowling alleys. There's always a way. It could be a malted or a soda or something, but people always do nice things for people they feel can help them. And I don't think there's anything wrong with it. As long as it's not anything completely unethical, a small favor is a way of our system, and there's nothing wrong with that, I don't think.
You've spent your whole adult life getting reflected in ratings books. Have you read them seriously? Have you taken them seriously? Do you let yourself be affected by it?
No. I have never, ever in my career, and I'm going to look you straight in the eye and tell you this, opened a rating book and studied it. You know what I do? To this day, I'll go over to Joe McCoy or I'll go over to any of my program directors and I'll say, how are we doing? And I wanted him to say, we're doing great, or hey, listen, we got a little problem in this area. That's all I know. I never study them. I don't care about them. Until you can tell me, Terry, maybe you can invent this, that you have wired each and every part of everybody's body 24 hours a day, I will then believe that you can measure people. You know, they consider us carrots. We are human beings. Because somebody listens to Cousin Brucey on a Tuesday, that doesn't mean they're listening on Wednesday and Thursday. If they want to wire me, 24 hours a day and study me for 10 years, I will believe perhaps what they're going to tell me. We ain't animals. We're not carrots. We're human beings. We're very changeable. But, you know, Madison Avenue and the people who spend the dollars and sign the checks need some sort of a yardstick, they say. I don't like it. I don't bother with it. I don't want to know about them. I just want to know, hey, how am I doing? Like Ed Koch would say, how am I doing? And if somebody says, A-okay, Cousin Brucey, and I make my audience happy, that's what I really care about.
Did you also not look at them to protect yourself, too, in case it got lower one day? Because I think a lot of people in radio have big egos but are really insecure. And
well,
they could be really demolished by a drop in the ratings.
I'd say we all have our normal insecurities. We're all are normally neurotic. But I try to keep so busy I can't remember it. And I don't want to think about it. I really don't. I'm sure I have my basic insecurities like everybody else does. And no matter how successful I am, I never really cared about the ratings. I just did not care about it. If it went down, I felt badly. You know what happened? When it goes up, I say, oh, hey, we're going to be heroes for the next 2 weeks again. Great.
You had a cameo in the movie
Dirty Dancing,
and your voice is also heard
throughout the film.
Throughout the film,
I also, by the way, picked all the oldies. I was the consultant, the musical period music consultant. They called me.
So, do you want to do more movies now?
That's a good question. That part that you saw me, and I played the magician. For those of you who have seen Dirty Dancing, and the voice all over the thing is my voice. That part took me 8 days. It took place in 1963, Terry, in the Catskill Mountains, and it took me 8 days to do that little part. I've been offered another role in a gangster movie, a big part. I'm thinking about it right now. I don't know. I like doing what we're doing right now. It's easier.
Well, it sounds like fun doing movies, too. I thank you a lot for joining us.
Is it over? I can't believe this is over. This has been so much fun.
Thank you so much for having me.
Please keep radio alive and do what you're doing, will you?
Did you love listening to radio, by the way?
I'm a radio listener, yeah. And please, I hope everybody enjoys my book.
Thanks for being here. And Cousin Brucey's new book is called Cousin Brucey, My Life in Rock and Roll Radio. And Cousin Brucey is, of course, Bruce Morrow, who got his start in New York on WABC Radio, a Clear Channel station. He can now be heard on CBS and on a syndicated radio show. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.